One day, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was doing a 24-hour shift, and I got a call for a code blue. So if you guys don't know what that means, it's basically, you know, someone's cardiac arresting somewhere in the hospital, right? And so it's my job in the ICU because I'm trained to take care of these people, these patients. So I went into this patient's room, and this patient was on the floor in the bathroom coding. And so I started to run the code. I turned around, there's shit in the toilet. I'm drilling into this lady's leg, trying to put an IV in her leg. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what the fuck am I doing with my life, right? Like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Collecting Keys Real Estate Investing Podcast with your host, Mike DeHaan and Dan Austin. From wins, losses, horror stories, and tactics for optimizing your business, Mike and Dan take a real, uncensored deep dive into the ins and outs of running a full-time real estate investment and wholesaling business.
What's going on, guys? On this episode of the Collecting Keys Real Estate Investing Podcast, we have Ryan Corcoran, who is a super legit off-market multifamily investor mostly.
Direct-to-seller multifamily investor.
Direct-to-seller, yeah. So he does kind of like what Dan and I do, but with like big properties, like big play properties with proper sophisticated buyers and sellers. So he doesn't have any of the super fun stories we have about like crackheads doing weird stuff or like sellers and tenants getting into fist fights, at least not that we know of.
No, he's helping old ladies pay for their husband's elder care. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, and I will say, as I say that, he did go through the phase of doing what we do and sort of graduated up to that.
Sure.
But he's still only 28 years old. So he has done a lot in a pretty...
Yeah, he buys most of his stuff too, which is, you know, kind of things that Mike and I aspire to as well. He's got 250 units right now under management that he's bought this way.
Uh-huh.
And I think like it was like I watched the clock around 20 minutes. He puts just some fire information out there on like how he's getting in contact with these owners because they're typically behind an LLC. So you got to go listen to that part and listen to it like three times because it's pretty interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. He goes all into the details about the nuances of marketing to these kind of sellers, how he's able to do it effectively, and the knowledge that he drops on that is really next level. So absolutely check it out and you guys will learn a lot. Anyways, guys, hope you enjoyed the show with Ryan. If you want to learn how to build the basis for finding off-market leads, you should go to collectingkeyspodcast.com/guide. You can download our 5-step process to start doing so in as little as 2 weeks. Get a little bit faster, honestly, if you wanted to. So go collectingkeyspodcast.com/guide to grab that little ebook that we have. Aside from that, guys, enjoy this conversation with Ryan and you know, let us know what you think afterwards. We're always looking for feedback on these shows. So thanks, everybody.
Enjoy.
Ryan Corcoran out of Rhode Island. For those who don't know how much of a badass you are, you've been kind of doing the circuits on various different podcasts and that sort of stuff recently. But who are you and what exactly do you do, Ryan? Because you have a lot of impressive things to talk about here today.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Should be fun. Should be a good time. So I'm out of Rhode Island. I am 28. I recently, about a year and a half ago, quit my W-2 job and jumped into real estate full-time. And I predominantly focus on multifamily properties. I wholesale some, I do a good amount of flips, and then we've got about 250 units that we hold so far for long-term rentals.
Nice. Damn.
I mean,
nice. Yeah, year and a half. So did you like just start real estate like a year and a half ago, or were you kind of doing it before you quit your W-2?
Yeah, so I bought a duplex when I was 21, actually. So I've been doing this for about 7 years. So yeah, a lot of people look at it and they're like, how did you do that so fast? Well, hold on a minute, man. It's been 7 years. I've been doing this for a while. So I bought a duplex at 21. I thought I was going to live in it. I ended up fixing it up, renting it, taking the $700 a month in profit every month. And that carried me through undergrad and then into my master's program. I was paid for my food, my gas, everything. And then I sold it, walked away with whatever, like an $80,000 check. And I was like, all right, that's almost my entire PA salary in a year and a half. So how can I do more of these? So then I went from a 2-family to a 3-family to a couple other small multis. Ended up selling all those and I jumped into larger commercial properties. So 10 unit buildings, 12 unit buildings, 6 units, stuff like that. So yeah.
You say PA, is that like physician's assistant PA? Is that your W-2 job?
Yep, correct. I worked, so it's essentially, I do the same, I basically play the roles of as a physician, but I didn't go to school for the same amount of time. I don't have the same amount of debt and I didn't make the same amount of money.
Right.
But yeah, same job. I worked in an ICU for about a year and a half while I was building up a portfolio and then one day it was like 3 o'clock in the morning and I was doing a 24-hour shift and I got a call for a code blue. So if you guys don't know what that means, it's basically, you know, someone's cardiac arresting somewhere in the hospital, right? And so it's my job in the ICU because I'm trained to take care of these patients. So I went into this patient's room and this patient was on the floor in the bathroom coding. And so I started to run the code. I turned around, there's shit in the toilet. I'm drilling into this lady's leg, trying to put an IV in her leg. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? Right? Like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, after that moment, I'm just like, all right, I got to figure this out. Like, these rentals are good. They make some money. They're great for net worth and great for long term, but I got to like drastically increase my income so I can get the hell out of here. So yeah, that's what I did. I started wholesaling some multifamily, started flipping multifamily, doing a couple of development projects right now. Yeah. So it's going well.
Yeah.
I love that story, the aha moment though. That I mean, yeah. I hate hospitals. So I'm glad that you're saying that work there. That you're like, I don't want to be here.
Yeah. And like people that work in those environments, they always have such crazy stories and stuff like that too. Yeah. I think, you know, people who can do that for the long term, I don't know, it's something special, I guess. Like one of my good friends, she's a nurse anesthetist. So she's always in the operating room and just sees like weird stuff that comes through. And like, we'll go to hang out with her and she'll be like, oh wow, this felon came in and he like shoved a spoon in his urethra today. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, that's like the most like extreme thing I can possibly think of. And that's what she sees on like a daily basis. Seriously. And that's a real story.
I have a lot of respect for people in the medical field. The thing is, like, while you're trying to build like another business on the side and you're trying to do the side hustle and trying to like do something that's more than make 130 grand a year, right? Like, don't get me wrong, at 25 years old, it's a good amount of money, but you know, I wanted to, my goals are way bigger than that. And so when you go into this hospital setting and everybody's like, why am I here? This sucks. It's just like, it brings your, basically your head game, everything drops, right? You're just like, God damn, like I want to get out of here. Like I have no motivation to be here. And so, you know, on the days I wasn't working, you know, I'm up at 4 o'clock in the morning, writing letters, sending them to people, researching, trying to do these things at the same time. And then one day I just said, you know what, screw it. I dropped the per diem. My wife was like, okay, if that's what you want to do, go for it. Super supportive at the time. And then I think she expected that I was going to work a lot more than I did. But nice. I ended up, just like stopped, pretty much cold turkey.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, that is nice. You had that support though. That's like the number one question that we get. So my story is kind of similar. So I was an engineer and I quit like cold turkey, and real estate wasn't even on my radar at that point. Like I went from making an engineering salary to like the next year I made, you know, like 16 grand driving for Uber and working as a weightlifting coach, right? I made like no money. And then real estate sort of came in after the fact. So I started like, you know, learning about business and those sort of things. But the number one question I always get from people is like, how'd you get your wife on board? But I was fortunate that my wife was like, well, if you're going to be less of a miserable prick, like I'm okay with you doing that, right? And not everyone has that situation. I'm sorry, if your wife isn't like that, that suck. Like it's a challenging thing. And there isn't some magic persuasive way to get them on board.
I agree. But I also think that, so correct me if I'm wrong, but while you were, after you quit, I'm sure you were super motivated to try to figure out what you're doing, right? So you were probably working really difficult to try to, we're working hard to try to figure out, right? So I think Kristen saw for me that I'm up at 4 o'clock in the morning every freaking day studying, trying to do this. Right. Like, how can I get this done? And so I think when they see that, it's a little bit different. If I was just like, hey, I'm done. I have no motivation to do anything. She would have been like, get your ass back in the fucking hospital, right?
Go get another job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, man, I remember when I stepped away, dude, it's just totally, and you, I'm sure you can relate. Like you go from having steady income, right? Whatever, 10,000 bucks a month from being a PA to literally zero steady income. And so I went from, I was buying ATVs, I had a couple snowmobiles, bought a new truck, right? Because I had steady income. Like I know I can pay for it. Yeah. The day that I stopped and I sold everything I had, and I'm like, I'm done. I'm not spending another penny because I don't know if I'll ever like make that money again, right?
Right.
And so then I started, you know, making a good amount of money every month, well over what I was making as a PA. And I still haven't spent a single dime on like literally anything. Like I drive the same truck. Nothing has changed. I eat the same food. I wear clothes with holes in them. Like it's like one of those things where it's like, you know, a lot of people say like, okay, well, you know, you're making a good amount of money. Why don't you just, you want a new truck, just go get one. I'm like, you guys don't get it. Like once you realize that how to make money, you don't actually want to spend money on things that don't compound and, you know, make you actually happier. And for me, it's the time that it's given me. And so if I have to spend more money, you know, I just have to work harder. Right. And so I'd rather, you know, stay status quo for a while and build up a, you know, just a massive egg before I start doing anything like that. So yeah, it was very eye opening actually.
Well, so what's the car? I thought that was your car. I picture your car in the background, man.
Oh, dude, that's a $4 million Bugatti. Someday. That'll be someday.
That's great.
No, actually, one of my goals is to, it doesn't necessarily have to be a $4 million Bugatti, but I would like to have a couple million dollar car collection that I use for charity events. Essentially what I want to do is, you know, have the collection paid for, but then use them to, you know, bring to car shows and have, you know, kids sit in them and just like, you know, experiences that people just don't get
totally
through cars, because I'm a car guy. But
I love that. That's really cool. So backing up, when you left your W-2, I'm curious, because that is a big leap to lose the income. Good thing is like you could self-insure yourself because you know how to save people's lives. So maybe medical insurance wasn't such a big deal. But my point being, bringing this up is like, was there a point for you where you're like, okay, I have enough income from my real estate that's at least covering my part of my monthly nut. So the worst case scenario, I go drive for Uber to feed myself. Like, was that in place for you, or were you just like, nope, I'm gone?
Yeah. So I had 100 rental units already, but you got to understand, like when somebody says you have 100 rental units, like what does that really mean? Because when you buy like a 10 unit property, you have to rehab it, right? So like you lose 50 grand that first year when you buy that property, spending money on it to try to get it stabilized. So in theory, I had, you know, probably 10 grand a month coming in rent. I never saw a penny of it. And when it did come in, it just sat in the bank account.
Because you don't know when you need it again.
Correct. So from that standpoint, yes, I did have some money that I probably had six to eight months of savings. So, I probably had 70 grand in the bank just sitting there if I quit my job, I got 7 months to figure my shit out.
Right.
But fortunately, the day that I quit, I said, I'm done. All I did was pass two deals to two people and I collected $40,000 in finder fees. And I'm like, okay, hold on a second. Yeah. I didn't even buy the property. I didn't have to wholesale. I didn't flip it. I did nothing but just pass somebody a deal. And I just made 4X what I would have made in 1 month as a PA. So then I started thinking, I'm like, all right, I'm good. Like I can figure this out now.
Yep.
So once that happened, then I started feeling a little bit more comfortable.
And that's something that like you talked about gets kind of highly overlooked. And we have to remind ourselves, real estate is highly illiquid. And when you're first stabilizing a portfolio, whether you went from 0 to 10 units or 0 to 100 units within a couple of years, it still takes time before you realize that income. I mean, in Mike and I's portfolio, like we're like now able to realize like pretty good income off of that. But like we've never personally taken like that money just comes in and sits in the bank account because you're going to buy a new one or you're going to have to restabilize one. When you're buying them fast too, you're taking on tenants and you're having to rehab properties after you've already burned them and all that. So it like it's just illiquid and it takes a bit to where you're like, okay, now I can live off of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Plus also, I mean, I don't know what you guys did, but I raised a little bit of money when I was starting off because I didn't have money, right? So I raised 150 grand to buy a 10 unit. So on top of, okay, keep money for the roof, keep money for a water heater, I got to spend 10 grand to flip the unit. I had a $1,500 note that I had over my ass that I had to pay every month until the property was stabilized. Then when I refi it, I can pay him off, right? So really each one of these properties takes about a year before you actually see money coming in. And then at that point, it's like, okay, stabilize the bank account, right? Let's just get like 15 or 20 grand from that one property sitting there.
Get some reserves.
Right. You know, I have a hard time believing when people say they live off rentals. It's unless it's like, you know, you've been doing this for 30 years and your mortgages are paid off, fine. But yeah, it's just tough. I don't know. It's tough.
It is tough. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, vanity metrics too with a lot of those things. And and that's always a big red flag for people that get into this business is, you know, when they say stuff like, There was a podcast, I didn't listen to it, but I saw the notes for yesterday and it was like, you know, it's like a 27-year-old that owns 1,000 units. And then you go down, it's like, and they said they own $8 million worth of real estate. I'm like going, that math doesn't really make sense to me that they own 1,000 units, but they have $8 million worth of real estate.
In India.
Yeah, right. Like, what are these things? And then, you know, or like even you see the people that are like, oh, I have 3 Airbnbs that I do Airbnb arbitrage and now we quit our jobs. Now we just like travel around Europe. I'm like, what do you like do over there? Like you just rent cardboard boxes? Like, you're not making that much money. You're a liar.
I don't get it. Yeah. Honestly, I might get some slack for saying this for whoever's listening. If I were to do things over again I focused on buying like long-term rentals first before I started to generate a lot of income. I don't think you should do that. I think what you should do is focus how to make a lot of money.
Sure.
And then you can worry about buying these long-term rentals. Yeah, because like my net worth went up very quickly buying long-term rentals, but you don't realize that income, right? You still have to have that W-2. You still have to be super creative and working your ass off. And I'm not saying you don't, you know, that stops. But if you can find a way to make, even if it's in your W-2 job, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, I don't know, $1 million a year before you start buying a bunch of rental properties, you have so much more confidence as you start to buy these. instead of worrying about how can I fix a, you know, a boiler when you have $0 for the property. So
absolutely. What you're saying is then you can make long-term decisions, not in a position of fear, but in a position more of abundance. And you tend to make more better decisions that way.
100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think you'll get flack on that from anybody whose opinion matters, because that's 100% true.
It's true. Like, I mean, honestly, we talk about that a lot.
Yeah. Well, even you go back to like the old school bigger pocket stuff, like the number two step that they would say is like, you know, make money, like figure out how to make, like increase your income, and then take that income that's newly found and increase the velocity of it by, you know, going investing at that point.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's where so many people get stuck, is they get so focused on like the passive income to quit their W-2, which is fine. Like, I understand that strong desire.
Yep.
But what they do is then they waste their time doing things they're going to make $400 a month, $300 a month. They'll go get like an Airbnb that makes them $1,000 a month, but they have to manage full time.
Yep.
When realistically, if you took that same amount of time and you went and you learned to wholesale a property, you learned to flip a property, you learned to be a freaking general contractor, you know, you go and you start, you become a realtor, you do anything
something
else.
Something scalable, right?
Yeah. Something scalable. You're going to make so much more money. And then the financial freedom will come almost on accident from doing that, instead of like having to be super patient and work your miserable job for 15 years and buying one rental property every 3 years that makes $300 a month or some bullshit and still be poor, ugly off the cash flow when you have like 10 properties that make $3,000 a month. Like,
yeah, no, I agree. That's a good summary of sort of how I feel and if I would do things differently.
Yep.
Hey, it is what it is, right? We live and we learn.
Well, I mean, also too, you're freaking 28. Like, you're fine.
You're doing okay.
So. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really look at it like that, though. I look at it like I've been doing this for 7 years and I should be a lot, you know, I'm not saying I should be further, but, you know, I've been doing this for, like, I've been doing this for a while, right? I just happened to jump into it when I was 21. I didn't start when I was 25, right? So, yeah, it's just like anything else. I mean, I have a buddy here in Rhode Island who he makes like $15 million a year. He's got a restaurant. He's got a plumbing business. He flips over 50 homes a year. He's insane, right? He's crazy. And he's 30. And so I'm looking at him like, all right, he's a year and a half older than me. And he is exponentially further than me. So I don't really look at like 28 as like a, you know, hey, I'm young. It is what it is, right? I started when I was 21. I've been doing this for 7 years. He was 17 when he started. So, you know.
Yeah.
You got a head start. Dang it. No, you're absolutely right. It speaks to who you surround yourself with, because naturally, if you surround yourself with folks like this gentleman you just described, you're going to rise to that level. And then you're going to pick your head up and you're going to look for a new group of people to aspire to, because eventually you really do. And Mike and I have seen that plenty of times in our own lives and others. Like, you do aspire to those that you're around with. And there's the whole cliche saying about it, but it is true.
Yeah, I think, I know we're going to talk about actual real estate at some point, but I think the whole networking aspect and getting around people who are doing things that just blow your mind is really the one thing that I think really separates people. Because, you know, ultimately, like, so I always tell this story. I moved here to Rhode Island. I knew nobody. I met up with a couple people. I asked everybody who the best players in the game were. And I found deals and I brought some deals to these people, right? Next thing I know, I'm in a room with six dudes that, you know, one guy's making $1 million a month. And I, at the time, was nowhere near that. And I'm still not near that. But I'm sitting next to this guy and I'm just like, this is unfreaking believable, right? So, and I look back and I'm like, holy shit, like I just 10x my income in the last like 8 months just by being around these people. And so I can't say enough about getting around people and bringing value to the people who you look up to, because you have to get in that room. And I don't care if it costs money to do it, right? We're in GoBundance, right? We pay what, 10, 15 K a year, whatever it is. But you get in the room like with people like you guys, right? And it's everything. That's literally everything.
Yeah. What's that old motto? You know, what they say, you're the sum of the five people you spend the most time with. Mm-hmm. Make those people, you know, A players. You're going to become an A player. If you spend all your time with alcoholics, I bet you're going to become an alcoholic.
You'd be really good at drinking.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Hey, everybody needs some skills.
Yeah. But awesome. No, that's good stuff. All right. Let's jump into some real estate stuff, though. But I do appreciate all that backstory and that insight. Like, those are some really, really valuable stuff there. So the real estate, though, I want to know about your process of doing direct-to-seller multifamily and wholesaling and flipping multifamily properties, because that is something that I feel like is relatively uncommon. Some people try to do it. We know a lot of people that do syndications. That's kind of the way that they do it. Where, you know, and with the syndication, if anybody listening doesn't necessarily know what that means, it's typically where you buy a property, normally from a broker, not always, but that's the most common way to do it. You increase the value of the property, usually by doing renovations, you know, adding amenities, whatever, and then you sell the property sometime down in the future, increase the rent. But doing it direct to seller is going to be a different beast, because typically when you're doing a syndication, you get like the finances that are previously there. You have a pretty streamlined game plan. When you're going direct to seller, I imagine it's a little bit different. I could be wrong, but I guess what does that process look like for you? And sort of like, how are you able to be successful doing multifamily? Because that's something that a lot of people do claim is impossible.
All right. So I don't really know anybody who markets to multifamily like I do. So that's number one. Okay. So I'm really the only one who's doing it around here because everyone says it's impossible to do. And so I said, fuck that. It's definitely possible because I've been doing it for 7 years. Okay. And so really what I do is it's all, for the most part, it's direct mail.
Yep. One more time. What was it? Say one more time. Direct mail. Thank you. That's what we do. And we get shit for it all the time. Yeah. So thank you.
It's the way
it's good
to go,
though.
Man.
I mean, I think direct mail is going away, right? That's what everybody says, but that's really good for people who are marketers, right? And I actually agree. I think a lot of people are going away from direct mail, but when your mail piece is one of three pieces of mail in the mail, guess who's going to get opened, right? Yep. And so if your piece is in there with two pieces of mail, it's going to get opened. Maybe if it's 20, like it was 10, 15 years ago, you know, people throw them out. But no, I think it's great. I think competition drops and it's a good marketing tool.
I still think like checking your mail is still kind of a cool thing. Like it's a surprise. And we get like our Amazon packages in our mailbox too. So you like know, but like, you know, you never know what you're going to get in the mail. So I still do think people like getting mail. And like you're saying, if less and less people are mailing, you just have a better chance of them opening your shit.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, I focus on direct mail. I've done some cold calling. I think about like one property cold calling. And the reason is I just didn't focus enough time and I didn't strategize it well enough because I focus on direct mail, right? So I've done some direct email. I bought a deal off of that. So that was pretty cool. But the rest of them, direct mail. And so the key with multifamily is that most of these things are hidden behind LLCs. And so when you mail an LLC, a couple things happen. Number one, almost always doesn't go to the actual owner because when you go on Inkfile or you go on one of these websites and produce an LLC to purchase a property, they ask you to put a registered agent in there. And so when you actually put a registered agent in there, it's usually either a property management company or an attorney. And so if I sent you guys a letter and I thought I was sending it to you and it went to your attorney, do you think your attorney is going to spend the time to let you know if you got a letter?
No.
Absolutely not. Okay. So what you have to do is you have to use websites like Open Corporates or you have to use the assessor websites and it's a lot of work. And so this is where VAs come really handy, but that's what we do, right? So we'll print like a list of maybe 10,000 properties and I'll have my VA take a couple of weeks and just go through the entire thing. Look up the LLCs, who the actual owners are, what's their actual mailing address, at their home. And then instead of spending money to send to registered agents or just the LLC address, we're sending it to the actual owner. So that has been a huge game changer. And a lot of people don't put in the time and effort to do that.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to ask some clarification on that. So when you go through Open Corporates, we kind of do a similar process. Still, sometimes we'll show the registered agent on there. You can find the principal that's listed sometimes on there. But then to find the actual individual, you just use like Spokio. Do you have another platform that's super good? Like there's a lot of like free people search, whatever.
So you can use those, but honestly, and it's a lot of work, but the best way to do it is just to whatever town it says that person's registered to, just type in like, for example, around here, Groton, Massachusetts property records. It will take you to the assessor's website. Just type the friggin' person's name in on that website and it will show you the house that they live, like where their primary address is, right? And so you now double check that, okay, what that Open Corporate said is in fact true. This person does actually reside here. And if they don't reside there, then they have done a really good job hiding behind a primary residence.
Yeah.
And you can't, it's not a whole lot you can do about that. But yeah, that's what I have them do. And so from a return rate, it's pretty high, right? When a lot of people say it's impossible, I get a good amount of callbacks from multifamilies.
Yeah. Yeah.
It gets much more challenging as you get to larger units. So if, you know, for example, if you're trying to buy a 30 unit apartment building, it's very difficult to do that because there's usually a lot of partners involved when you actually look at that LLC and it's almost impossible to know which one has the decision making. So it gets a little dicey there. So it really works well for your small multis to up here in New England, 15, 20 unit buildings. So,
yeah, that would make sense. That's like the sweet spot too, where people may have a registered agent, but you also may be able to find it. We have a very similar process within our county. We can't search by name, unfortunately. So we'd have to go to Spokio or something similar. If once we get a name, find which addresses are tied to them, plug those into our county records, assuming they live locally, and then we can typically find their primary. But again, if they're hiding behind some other LLCs or trusts on their primary, you might not find them.
Yeah.
That's smart. So you send out the letters. You know, you go and you find the individuals. What sort of mail are you sending them? Is it, I guess, is it letters? Is it postcards? Is it branded? Is it personal?
I've done pretty much everything you could possibly imagine. And the one thing that I stick to for the last couple of years that I have not changed on is, honestly, guys, I just like a white letter with handwritten on the outside and a stamp and just a handwritten return. Because if I go look in my mailbox and I see a purple letter, personally, me, I'm kind of just like, all right, this is just like kind of gaudy. Like someone's just trying to get my attention. Like, but if it's an actual white letter that somebody went and bought at Walmart and they're sending me this, it just gives it that little bit of a personal touch where it's like, hey, this person is actually directing this letter to me personally. Isn't bombing them out to a bunch. I remember sure. I used to send postcards, some with like a logo on the outside, and I would get a call back, right? It would be like, I'm sure you sent this to a million people. What's the deal, right? I don't get that anymore. I get, yeah. Hey, you know, you dropped a letter off at my house, right? So I've got like a lot of those calls. And so it really gives it that personal touch, especially to the people who this is the only property they own, right? They're not big landlords.
Hey.
Yeah, I don't know. I found a lot of success with it. So a lot of people say that's stupid and whatever. It is what it is. Everyone has a different game plan and a different business model. It works really well out here. So
well, you bought 250 units that way. So
yeah, it works everywhere. I mean, in our local market, we've done it for years. In all the virtual markets we've done, we've had good success with it.
Yep.
And we've tried, similar to you, so many other things, cold calling. We do texting now, and we've actually had some pretty good results with that. But we mostly do that for like, just to keep costs appropriate, because we're doing residential, right? For like yep. high equity or like seniors or things like that. And if I was like, if we were to mail all those people, the ROI would just get kind of weird.
Yep.
But I mean, the direct mail though is just tried and true. It's consistent. Yep. It's always our best deals, because another thing about direct mail is that they choose to call you. You're not outreaching right. to them. That's unsolicited. And so
100%.
As so soon as better. They call you on a letter, they've raised their hand and they're like, hey, I would like to have a conversation.
Oh my God, dude, preach. This is the thing with direct mail, right? You send a letter out to somebody. If they're calling you back on a letter, you need to realize that regardless of what they say on the phone, they're calling you back for a reason.
Yeah.
And so it's your job as an off-market specialist to figure out why they are calling you. They might sit there and say, no, I'm not interested. But there is a reason they called you, right? So you need to find a way to do that. And a lot of this, and you guys, I'm sure you guys feel the same way, is this isn't real estate, right? Like doing this like off-market thing is not real estate. It's really just a marketing funnel, and it's helping people, right? Almost all your good deals, are you pulling people out of shit positions and helping them essentially, right? That's what we do for multifamily, right? I buy properties where tenants aren't paying. I buy properties where they don't have 50 grand to fix the units, right? So fortunately, we're in a position as investors to be able to help people like that.
Shit, man. Yeah. I think we might be like the same person. What you said there was
the exact same things.
Was what I said to every single family member at Thanksgiving who was like, so what are you doing? I'm like, well, really, it's like a marketing business. And like, I help people out, but like the payment is the property.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Like that is so, so true. And that can't be overstated enough as well, where a lot of people, I mean, Dan and I, we made this mistake too when we jumped in. They look at it as a real estate business. So when you go and start talking to leads, all you care about is the real estate.
Yep.
And really, that's not what matters at all. It's all about what is the person's problem? Why did they call you? And how can you solve that? And, you know, is the compensation, the price for the house, does it make sense for the problems that you're trying to solve?
Yeah. Yeah. I just got off the phone with, before this, a couple hours ago, this lady owns a 6-unit in a town local, Taunton, Massachusetts. And she called me and she's like, well, you know, I'm interested in selling. I owe $150,000 on the property. I need $300,000 to put my husband into senior care. And I was like, I didn't care what she said about the numbers. I don't care anything else. But I pulled the fact that she said he needs to be in senior care out of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually went to their house, which is a 6-unit. They live on the bottom floor.
Oh, wow.
And we sat there for an hour and a half and we talked about his husband's dementia. Which the situation she's in, I didn't even walk any of the freaking units, guys. And the next thing you know, she says, really, all I need is like $100,000 and I'm good. I walked away signing a 6-unit property for 50% off of market value because we just bonded, right? Like that's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
We're helping her out of a situation. We get a good deal out of it.
Yep.
That's all it is.
That's awesome, man. I love that.
That's a great story.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's how you find the properties. I would love to know, I guess, about your basic analysis and doing things like this off market, because when you're using a broker, when you're buying multifamilies on market, you typically get financials. Generally, there's going to be clear title. There's not going to be anything weird. When you're going into multifamilies, especially, there's going to be a lot more questions that potentially exist, especially, you know, larger CapEx items, potentially a lot of weird stuff with tenants. How do you approach those situations with the sellers? And like making sure that you're protecting yourself and you're actually getting good deals. Because analyzing them too is also a bit different than single family.
Yeah. So for singles and condos, a lot of it's comping, right? Okay.
For
so
sure.
I don't do any comping, like at all. Like I'm not good at it. I don't comp things at all. And so I really know, like I've done a lot of research in the market that, okay, what are price per unit selling at in, I don't know, Bristol, Rhode Island, right? Okay, they're selling at 150-ish a unit for half decent condition. So that right there gives you a good base that, okay, if I'm walking through this thing and it's like half decent, I just know that, all right, roughly 150 is what market is. And so if I have at least a baseline, I can start to go in and start to evaluate, okay, you know, it's going to need 10 units rehabbed out of the 12. It needs a new roof. And I can just start mentally like breaking it down from there. I think we talked about, you know, using agents is kind of difficult when you're trying to find really good deals sometimes, right? But I think agents are very valuable in this business because if you can buddy up with an agent, all you have to do is take some pictures, tell them about the property, and they can tell you exactly what the thing is worth if they're good, right? And so I can't tell you how many times I've walked a property and I'm like, I don't know, like okay, is it worth 450? Is it worth 500? And I'll call up my buddy and I'll be like, hey man, I've got this property in New Bedford, 6 units, you know, what do you think it's going for? And he's like, lock it up or walk away, you know, stuff like that. So I wouldn't just rely on you every single time. Try to cross-reference and cross-check things off with people who are experts in that particular market until you become an expert at that market. But yeah, you're not really comping like an 8-unit property. It's based on income, right? And so you can get all the rents you want and you can divide it by that cap rate and see what number it spits out. That's another way to give you a good baseline. But again, at the end of the day, most of this is trying to build a relationship with somebody, and the number usually reflects how good you are at solving their problem. Right. And so that's really,
absolutely.
Like I said, I just don't comp things. I really don't. That just comes from experience though. Right. So I think you just got to be out there. And if you're not sure about something, still go to the property, walk the property, meet the person. And then when you're done, you can go home and look some stuff up, make some calls, you know, talk to some other investors and do it that way.
Nice.
Yeah. I think that's super, super valid. And, you know, saying it comes with experience too, you can't overstate that enough. I mean, even now, like we'll have people that we reach out to us looking for opinions on valuation, or we have like a group mastermind, the instant investor program, and we'll have people that come into that and they'll be like, I'm trying to figure out how to comp these properties efficiently. Like they want to be able to do it faster. I'm like, well, you probably got to do it a little bit slow first, get used to doing the process. And then once you know how to do it and what stuff goes for in your area, like I can know what a property is probably worth just based off the street that it's on.
Right. Yeah.
All I need to know is like the bed bath count in the street. I can be like, eh, we're going to need to be at like 150 for that, you know? And like, that's all it takes. But that just comes with experience.
You also get to the point to where you're like, oh, it's on that street. It's a 3-1 probably, unfinished basement. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 350. You know, yeah, like, you know, exactly. So well. But you also, yeah, I think to build your confidence, you have to buy one or two. You have to sell one or two. You have to understand. You have to like make your pro forma numbers actually be fact. And then you just get so much more confidence. And that's the experience that helps you go fast.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want to pass over this. I think you got, you know, if you really get to know investors in your market, they become your buddies, right? Like, so if you're not sure about something, just call people, you know, don't just like call people. Be like, what do you think about this, right? I can't tell you how many times I still do that. And, you know, if it's just outside my expert, you know, my little expertise area, if I'm not sure, I'll make a call to somebody I know over there. And I'm like, hey, this is what I got. What do you think? You know, I have an opportunity to lock it up at this. Do you think it's worth it? No? Okay, fine. On to, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, back to surrounding yourself with those key people.
Yep.
So I guess the disposition process on this, you said you wholesale stuff. You obviously buy quite a lot, which is one thing. I mean, that's relatively easy to put together. But on wholesaling these sort of properties, what does that process look like for you on these multifamilies? Do you have like key buyers? Do you shop it around? Do you use broker?
All right. So wholesaling in my world, with multis at least, it's very difficult to find a good amount of actual good buyers who can buy an 8-unit building for 800 grand, right? It's very hard to find those people. So what I do is I try to almost reverse wholesale it, right? So if I find a deal in, I don't know, any town around here, I've built up a good amount of network around here where I know who buys in that area. So instead of like sending a property out to a bunch of people, I will specifically pick like one or two people I know who I can trust that if this is actually a good deal, they're going to buy it. Mm-hmm. And so I'll have them walk the property with me. And so instead of locking the thing up and sending it out, having open houses and trying to get people in there and trying to wiggle around the seller and lying to the seller, like I don't do any of that stuff, right? I completely avoid that. And I try to reverse wholesale to people. And if that does not work, if I have it under agreement, I'm going to buy the property because I get under agreement for a price that I would personally pay. And so, yeah, that's sort of how I navigate that. Like I said, I don't do a ton of wholesales. I'm going to start increasing that a little bit just because I don't really know where the market's going. But yeah, I go into it thinking, okay, if I can buy it at this price for me personally, I'll lock it up. And then if I know somebody specifically who is looking, for example, just make it easy. I got a 10 unit off market property in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. I went to go look at the property. It was in good shape. I made an offer on the property for $775,000. CJ, we talked about before the show, I know he buys bigger multis in Woonsocket. So I just called CJ and I said, CJ, I have this property under agreement for 775. It's probably worth 900. I'll give it to you for eight. And so I just assigned it to him for 800, right? And so I didn't have to send it off to a bunch of buyers. I didn't have to walk a bunch of people through it. But that's really just the nature of the larger multis. It's going to be really difficult to have an open house on a 10 unit building.
Yeah. And just the tenants and getting into all of them. Yeah. It is a headache to do these. So I like what you're doing is you're kind of making sure you're finding people that are interested and you're bringing them with you. And then with confidence that one of those guys, if it's a good deal, they're going to buy it. That's the trick.
Yeah. And that's why I haven't taken the wholesale business to a scale level because I'm just not, well, not that I'm not comfortable. I really just have no interest in wholesaling 100 properties a year that are that big. Right. I mean, I'd have to do the whole East Coast if I'm going to, you know what I mean? Like there's also not as many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The buyer pool's smaller because you're right. It takes a level of sophistication and wealth to buy an $800,000 building.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 100%. Or bigger, right? Like I just came across 114 unit. Like who the hell's going to buy that? Right? Like it's $20 million. Like if I can lock that up for 17 million and it's worth 18 million, great. I can make $1 million on an assignment fee, but like, how am I going to find, right? You got to bring this to like a VC firm, right? Uh-huh. And so it's really difficult. It can be done. I mean, I know people do it, but I haven't blown the wholesale business up for that reason.
That's cool, man. Well, yeah, full cycle. I love it. And it's interesting because it's, you know, same basic principles that you do with residential. It's just different kind of asset, different kind of conversation with the seller, different sort of sophisticated buyers. But just like we see a lot of people, it's not freaking rocket science.
Yeah.
You know, and it is doing the boring process of sending out these white mailers as boring as they can get, having these conversations. You're going to spend 90 minutes with the seller in their house, probably having a terrible cup of coffee in a conversation that you're loosely interested in, maybe, or, you know, highly interested in, depending on how personable you are.
Right.
But that's what gets this business going, right? That's what the business is at its core.
Yeah. Yeah. I also want to mention that, okay, so multifamily properties have a spread. If you're going to wholesale them, they can be real large, right? And so it's not unheard of to make $150,000 on an assignment fee with a 10 unit property.
Yeah.
To get $150,000 assignment fee on a $200,000 single family, I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's much more challenging, right? Like what's an average wholesale fee for you guys? 20, 25? Maybe 30?
23 and a half is our average. Okay. Our largest, we've had one 100,000, but it was a piece of land.
Perfect.
On like a house, beautiful. It's not common.
Exactly. So CJ said the same thing. 27.5, I think, is his average. And the most he did was a 90. Now that's a lot. A $90,000 on a freaking single family house is a lot. But for me, a $90,000 assignment fee on a $900,000 property is like, it's like, okay, right? And so like how many of those do you have to do really? I mean, you do 10 of them a year and you're almost at $1 million, right? And so that's why I like the multifamily space because I've adopted this sort of mentality that, all right, I did a bunch of twos, did a bunch of threes. The larger I go, the more money it is. It's just numbers. And I don't have to work as hard. It's not as many transactions. I don't have to have this massive team. Just me and a couple of guys, and we can make $1 million just wholesaling on the side of a buy and hold business, right?
And I think the more sophisticated people on each side, and both the sellers and the buyers too, just make it easier. Because that's like we're looking to get out of the residential, just because honestly, we're sick of dealing with crackheads, man.
Yeah.
We're dealing with crackheads for 2 years.
They got the best of us.
Oh my God, it's just nonstop. You know, like our guy walked through a mobile home out in Idaho a couple weeks ago, and they had like eight generations of inbred chihuahuas in this house.
Oh,
and he was telling our sales guy about how all the ones being born now are all smooth headed on one side because they don't have ears anymore.
Like, what?
They don't even have
it's
a hole.
Absolutely ridiculous.
I didn't know that. That's so gross.
You know, it's like we're going to deal with this situation, rehoming eight generations of chihuahuas to make like 14 grand. Fuck that. It's not worth it anymore.
Yeah, no, not worth it. It's not worth it.
So, Jesus. Anyway, man, awesome. Well, so much good stuff in your mind. I really appreciate it.
So
we're getting to the end of the show here. I want to jump into our end of show questions.
Sure.
I'm sure you got some good answers on these. So first question we like to ask people, which is the crowd favorite, is what is your craziest real estate investing story? And this can be a crazy seller, big win, major loss, a huge like surprise turn that came out in a deal, kind of whatever you got.
All right.
Just one caveat though. It cannot be about like a dead tenant or seller melting into the floor. We've had a handful of those.
A lot of those.
And I'm trying to, it's super bummer. They're supposed to be like entertaining, not like, man, that's horrific.
All right. I'm doing one right now that it's crazy because I never thought it would turn into what it is. So sending letters, right, to a bunch of multifamily property, and a letter ended up going to a guy who owned a couple pieces of land all next to each other. So I brought it to a guy I know who's a developer. And the next thing you know, we were buying a piece of land for 250 grand that we're putting 21 units on that's worth $9 million. And damn. So I went from a, is this like, what is this, to $3.5 million in equity almost overnight just by entitling a piece of land, which it's absolutely insane. My mind was blown. And so now I'm like, what the, like, I got to start mailing land. Like, I got to like focus on land deals. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. So that it's still, I still think about it. I'm like, what the just happened. Like,
that's,
it's crazy.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That is a cool
so
deal.
How did that come together with the builder? Like, I guess, like, how did you know how to build 21 units? Because it's something that we've talked about. So people ask about this all the time.
Yeah. So we actually, we just last night, we got approved for the entitlement. And so today we could probably sell it for $2.5 million. And we just bought the land for 275. So my buddy's actually a developer, the one I brought it to. And so are we going to sell it? I don't know. Are we going to take it down and net 3 to 5 million? I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know what's going to happen. We still have to talk about it, but we just got approved last night.
How long did it take you to get to that phase? How, when you got it under contract, and did you buy it and then go through entitlement, or did you hold like LOI under contract?
Yeah. So we just got it under P&S. So we locked it up, and we told the seller that we will give you 275 in cash if you hold out until we have all entitlements for everything. So the day that we actually close on this thing, it's going to be shovel ready. And so that'll be a couple of weeks from now.
That's the way
to do that. We had somebody else recently who said, give similar advice to that about going through that whole process before you lock up all your money and you're stuck with this thing.
You still probably have costs and stuff involved in it, but you're not on the hook for a $275,000 piece of property that's actually worth $100,000.
Yeah. We spent $70,000 entitling it. So we'll be into it for about $350,000-ish. And then it'll be worth, about $2.5 million as is.
Awesome. Did you have like stuff work, like extensions and things like that worked into the contract so that the seller couldn't be like, you know, somebody comes around and offers them $500,000, for example, and he can just like wait you out and tell you to F off?
Sure. So I built a very good relationship with the seller.
Okay.
So again, comes down to relationships, right? I met this guy 5 times at the friggin' land. I called him. We talked about airplanes. He sent me a picture of him hunting a deer in Vermont. Like that type of relationship, right? I do with most of the people I buy from. And so when I locked this P&S up, I just said, listen, I'm not going to put like a date on here. We're just going to say this is valid until we have permits for everything. And so I don't have to get an extension. I don't have to call him back. He knows what's going on. He's probably thinking to himself like, what the hell did I just like give away? But you know, it's not much at this point he can do about it. But it's just under a P&S, and we have it in there that says we have this until all permits are accepted. Or if we don't have the permits accepted, we back out and there's no risk.
Nice.
We don't have any money. We didn't even tie money up.
So you didn't even really have like an expiration. Basically, the agreement was you had it until you were done with that. That's
correct.
Cool.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I guess like just one more question on this. Hypothetically, what if it had taken you like 4 years? Could he have, is there any sort of time on it? I can't imagine it's like an indefinite contract.
So that's a good question. I mean, I think, so we established that it was going to take about 6 months. And so his expectation was that it was going to take us 6 months. And he's developed real estate for a long time. So he actually knows. I don't think he knew what he had. So we actually thought about that. We're like, oh my God, like we spent 70 grand on this. What if he just cancels it, takes the plants, just runs with it? But then we talked to the attorney and they're like, no, actually, you know, you guys are under P&S. Like this, I know there's no date on the, the expiration date on it, but it's still in process. Like you guys are doing everything you can to get the permits. Like you can't back out of this right now. Yeah. That's a good question though. We did think about that actually a couple of weeks ago. We're like, what are we doing? Yeah. Is he just going to run away with this?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You just never know. But
that's cool.
Awesome. That's cool. Well, congratulations. That's a big deal. Let us, you have to keep us in the loop as it
absolutely
all comes together.
Yeah. Over here.
Yeah.
Awesome. So second question, what is the number one piece of advice you would give for a new investor looking to get started or a small-time investor looking to take their business to the next level?
Sure. All right. So a lot of people say, you know, go educate yourself as much as you can. I agree with all that. I think what you should do is go read 3 books, like just any 3 books on real estate, and then stop reading books and just start implementing everything you've learned. And so to do that, so you read those 3 books, let's say it's the Burr book and some other books, you learn about rental properties. Next thing you have to do is get around people who are doing them. Get in the room with people who are doing it. Go to meetups. just get around people that are doing it. Like we talked about before, you have to start building your network. And so once you have a little bit of knowledge, you're around people that know what they're doing and you can learn from people. It's very simple and it's shitty advice, but just fucking do it. Like you just have to jump in and do it.
Yeah.
It's such a difficult question to answer. It's like, there's no tactile advice besides just go do it, man. Like figure it out. You have to just figure it out.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I think, yeah, not being an education junkie, and don't be a seminar junkie either. Because a lot of people, they take like, I need to be around people to being like, you know what? I need to pay 30 grand every year to go to the Rich Dad Conference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just flush that money down the toilet. And then they don't ever actually do anything actionable.
They spend so much on education.
I've never been to a seminar. I've never been to a conference. I paid for like 2 books. The rest of them, I friggin' downloaded them online for free. Like, I spent, you don't have to spend a lot of money to do it. Just start absorbing information.
Exactly. And like general price point for that sort of stuff too. If you are going to join like a mastermind or you can join a group, like, so we have our mastermind, for example, and Dan and I, we got started a mastermind, which is like game changer for us. Nothing in this business should cost like $30,000.
Oh God, no.
Ever.
$50,000 to learn how to flip a house.
It is horseshit. Don't do that. You know, like I would say like 10 is probably kind of like getting up there for like a yearly cost, you know, and like that's for like something that's like pretty primo, pretty established, but like don't ever pay anybody more than that for educational content in real estate because they are full of shit. You can get all the same stuff they're going to say for so much cheaper.
Yes.
And if you really, if you're not the type of person that can just watch YouTube videos and figure it out, like you can get a streamlined course for like $5,000.
Yeah,
totally.
You can get a wholesaling course for like $5,000 online. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a ton of them. Just bite them. And if you can't come up with 5,000, here's the other thing. If you can't come up with $5,000, this is not the business for you to be in. And I'm not saying that to be rude, but like, dude, I don't care what you got to do. Go borrow it from your parents, borrow it from friends. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you have to learn to be comfortable with that because I don't know how many times you guys borrow money. Like, I borrow a lot of money very often and it shuffles around everywhere. You have to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely. Truth. Yeah. I mean, you need money to make money in this business. All the people that say you can just do everything with other people's money.
Yeah.
They're just like all those people that have three Airbnbs and travel around Europe. They're liars.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough.
So,
or they're in jail.
Yeah. $5,000. You can come work with Dan and I, and it'll be less than that. So
exactly.
And we'll get to set up with exact stuff that we do. So
yeah. And another thing I want to say here is that like if you are not confident in doing everything yourself, all you have to do is get just good at one of the portions of real estate. So it could be you get good at finding somebody who has money. You get good at finding deals. You get good at finding connections to people. When I started, I had $0. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and so I bought a printer that I still have, pens, paper, and envelope, and I started handwriting all my letters. And I was coming across deals, and I started networking. I was just shuffling deals to people. And the next thing you know, I'm 10% equity here, 15% equity there. Oh, here's a $20,000 finder's fee, right? And that was 6-7 years ago. And so people start to recognize you as that guy, and the world just opens up. So
that's awesome. Absolutely. You had the hustle. You have the hustle.
Yeah, exactly. And that if exactly you don't have the knowledge, you don't have the money, the hustle is the number one thing that you can fill that gap with, right? Because people that have money, they don't want to hustle anymore. They made their money. They will happily pay you to hustle if you're willing to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Totally.
Awesome. So much good stuff, Ryan. All right. So last question, where can people find you, follow you, and reach out to you if you'd like to do so?
Sure. All right. So I've got a YouTube channel. It's just Ryan Corcoran. I've got an Instagram that I've had a very bad relationship with social media. I've been so bad with it for the last like 6-7 years. So this past, you know, the last like 3 months or so, I've started ramping up. So Instagram, RJCORCORAN08, same on TikTok. And then YouTube, just my name. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to try to work on the social media a little bit. I see a lot of people really putting and double downing on doing content. And I think it's huge. You know, like I said, I shit on it for a while, but now I'm looking at it. I'm like, wow, these people are making more than I'm making just by making a video. This is insane.
Yep.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. It doesn't naturally come to you. We're always working on that as well. At least I am. Dan's like, fuck it. I don't want to do that.
It's brutal, man. It's not fun. It's
I just don't have the time to put into it and I don't love it enough to do it. I'm getting better though. I'll get better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but awesome. Cool. We'll definitely go and hit up Ryan on Instagram and YouTube. And you said TikTok and you're in all the places right now. So either way, I'm sure you would be happy to chat with anybody that reached out to you.
Yeah, so, 100%.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Ryan. So much good stuff here. I really, really appreciate your time. And, you know, I wish you really good success, especially on this big deal that you have.
Yes.
So, you
should come. Yeah, man. It's been fun. It's been a good time. The time went by quick.
Yeah, it always does. That's a sign of a really good conversation. We're even over our time. But awesome. Well, thanks so much for listening, everybody. Please go and leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, if you want to know how to start generating off-market leads with a really quick, simple breakdown, go to collectingkeyspodcast.com/free. You can get our free 5-step guide to start generating off-market leads pretty much right away. You go through the stuff in there, you'll be able to talk to people in about 2 weeks. So collectingkeyspodcast.com/free. You can grab that guide. Aside from that, everybody, thanks so much for listening. Talk to you all next week.
See ya.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Please make sure you subscribe and leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcast. Also, please make sure you go and you share this with other people within your network. We are really trying to grow this thing, and the best way for us to do so is by you telling other people to come check us out. You can also follow us on Instagram. I am at Mike_invest. Dan is at InvestorManDan. You can follow the podcast at Collecting Keys Podcast. And if you want to learn how to make real money as a real estate investor, or you want to grow your already existing real estate investing business, please go and check out instantinvestorprogram.com and book a call with either Dan or myself, and we will see if you'll be a good fit. Thanks for listening, everybody, and talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening. Please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And check us out at collectingkeyspodcast.com for tips and guides on starting your own real estate investment and wholesaling business.